Delighted to say that Professor Rachel Muirs has been able to join us today. Thank you very much, Rachel, for sparing the time to be with us. Rachel is a professor in theology at the University of Leeds, where her research and her work focuses on the relationship between Christian doctrine and ethics, with particular focus on gender, feminism and the environment, as well as social class. And it's social class that Rachel is going to talk to us about today in our Life on the Redline conference, as she speaks to us about discerning the body, Christian social action, theology and class in austerity Britain. Thanks very much, Rachel, and over to you.
Well, listen, it's really good to be here, and it's a real privilege to hear both from Chris and Stephanie and from Sarah. It's one of these situations with coming towards the end. If I'd known what everybody else was going to say, I would rewrite the paper completely because there's so many big issues here that I'd love to engage with. I'll run with mostly with the paper I've got, and I'll try and draw some connections across as we go, because I think one of the things we lose in this mode is an opportunity for conversation. So the first thing I want to do actually is take us somewhere where it's already been referred to, which is Grenfell. Because in thinking about austerity in the present time of COVID-19, I've been helped by a recent paper by Margaret Adam and David Clough. It's a research project based at the University of Chester that was presented at this conference. You've got a reference to there on the slide, so you can pick it up and look at it. It's a paper in which Adam and Clough characterised the COVID-19 crisis as apocalyptic in theological terms. That is, as vividly disclosing and exposing to judgment the meanings, tendencies and orientations of long-term social structures and forces. So this idea that in apocalypse, you're presented with the truth about what's been going on all this time very vividly in a way that means you can't avoid seeing it. And Adam and Clough made this argument about COVID-19, that this is in the UK an apocalypse, a revealing and unveiling and in theological terms, an exposure to judgment of the effects of austerity and of systemic racism. The reason Grenfell's here is that I saw very persuasive analysis to a similar effect around the apocalypse, the revealing exposure to judgment of austerity and racism in relation to the Grenfell Tower fire, particularly in this poem by Ben Okri, "If You Want to See How the Poor Die, Go to Grenfell." And in some ways, Grenfell seemed to do the apocalyptic job, the job of revealing what's going on, exposing it to judgment, making it impossible to avoid seeing the meanings, tendencies and orientations of long-term social structures and forces more effectively than COVID-19 has. Although, given the very recent political developments around Grenfell, I might want to revise that as well. In relation to COVID-19, you could talk about it in this as an apocalypse, as the revealing of the problems that we've got and their effects and tendencies. But it does now seem clear that, well, what I see, don't know what you see, that there's a genuine risk of this society not learning what was wrong with the old normal, not responding to this vision, but of scrambling and fighting and allowing more people to die in order to put the whole thing back together just like it was. But the COVID-19 apocalyptic moment might still be a moment in which the accumulated expertise of Christian communities and Christian social activists, such as are gathered here today, and some of the reflections of Christian theologians and other scholars, can draw attention to how our social vision collectively has been captivated and distorted during and before the time of austerity, and offer glimpses of an alternative vision. To be clear, though, I'm going to say in this paper that the sorts of distortions of ways of seeing things, distortions of the social body that gave us austerity, have roots in Christian theology and Christian communities. I'm not doing the bad secular world against good Christianity. I'm not doing theology saving the world. Rather the reverse, because I think theologians' visions need their own therapy and shifts of perspective, some of which can be provided by close attention to the experiences of those engaged in social action, which is why I've really happy to invite you to conferences like this. I'm really sad not to be able to actually talk with you. So in this paper, hoping I've got enough time to do some of what I want to do, I want to ask how we can draw out some of the political and theological implications in Christian social activists' experiences of, I've talked about care, connection and celebration. And I'm going to use my work on theology and social class to ask about the deep sorts of structural problems that activist experiences of care, connection and celebration can challenge, and also to show why it's really hard to mobilise those experiences politically. Now, you've actually got a problem here, haven't you, because you can't see my slide nearly as... Look, I'm just going to try this and see if it works. Can you now see my slide?
Yes, we can.
Perfect. Great. I'm starting with this question about how we draw out political theological implications in Christian social activists' experiences. I've been talking a lot over the last few years during the class project about the biblical narrative of the woman who anoints Jesus. I decided not to let her take over this paper because some of you have probably heard me talk about her already. But hopefully you recall the story. This is, it's told in different forms in all four Gospels, in interestingly different forms that I can go on about but won't. But the key event is the woman entering the space where Jesus is having a meal with disciples and pouring ointment, very expensive ointment, either on his head or on his feet, and a dialogue ensues about the cost of the ointment, in which reference is made to poverty, to the needs of the poor. I focus first for this paper, there's loads of bits of this story we could play with. The bit I focus on first for this paper, is actually just this idea of anointing somebody. It's a scene of care. Of intimate encounter with the particular needs and desires of a body. It's a scene of connection, including an unexpected connection across boundaries, and it's a scene of celebration. It's a meal, and it's a beautiful thing that's done. Some of you know the literature on this text, and you'll also be quite aware that, at least in some of the gospel stories, it's a political moment. It's a woman making somebody king, right? Proclaiming Jesus as the Lord's anointed. It's anointing somebody is also a political action. One of the ways that I've come to read this story, thinking about the paper, is as an account of just how easy, it's a rather sad story, about how easy it is to marginalise and compartmentalise the work of care, connection and celebration, the work of Christian social activists. It's a nice extra. The work of care, connection, celebration, this kind of intimate encounter where nice things happen. It happens in private, non-political spaces. The space is called religion and voluntary work. The space is also associated disproportionately with women and their work. It doesn't this change anything about how society is organised. The poor are still, as Jesus says in the same story, always with us. So you have something that starts out looking like a really radically disruptive event, this sort of distinctly non-respectable woman in all versions of the story, really, breaks into hierarchically structured space and makes a big personal and political statement. And it gets turned, without anyone really noticing it, into a charming little sideshow to the main event, which I see as a parable not only about where the churches can end up in a secular age, in a secular society, sort of nice add-on to make people feel better around the edges, but also about how Christian social action in a time of austerity can end up, right, as a way of providing distractions, providing a sort of basic maintenance around the sides, but allowing the systemic problems to stay in space. And that also says to me something about what use theology might be, because although on one level in this story, what makes all the difference is the woman's action, is what the activist, what the person I'm sort of framing, if you like, is the activist is doing, a great deal depends on how her story is told over and over again, wherever the gospel is proclaimed in memory of her. So I suppose when I'm thinking about what it is to turn Christian social activism into theology, I'm thinking about what how actions like this are to be remembered and spoken about in ways that don't betray their significance. One of the links I'd really like to make to the work that's been done so far on this particular project, I won't say I've read everything on the website, but I've enjoyed looking at much of it. I was particularly struck by Stephanie Denning's work on persistence in volunteering. So she's studying, if I've read it right, this is a study of not just of why people start volunteering in faith-based activism, but what happens to them as they continue. And one of the interesting things this work highlights is the importance of bodily lives and emotional patterns in the lives of volunteers in faith-based activism. I think this really could link up in interesting ways to Sarah's work on social reproduction. So Stephanie's work is describing the embodied experience of spending time over time attending to particular needs, lives and stories, maybe out with what might be one's ordinary or default social circles. It's an account of how these actions and patterns of care, connection and celebration reform social bodies and social vision. So they reform the way individuals see things, but because they're performed in social spaces, they also reform patterns of relationship, ways of seeing things in the middle. And this is all going on in the middle of a context shaped by austerity and by class division. So this is worth emphasizing the potentially deep-seating and enduring change that everyday practices of care, connection and celebration can bring about. And my questions are how that comes to make a difference politically and theologically. And one of the ways I get into the problems to which I want it to make a difference is by thinking about social class. Now, at this point, I would really like to stop sharing my screen, but I'm having massive problems with my local system, so I'm going to not worry too much about that. And you're going to be looking at some nice pictures while I'm talking about something else. Okay. So the theological work on social class. Why am I interested in it? Why do I think it's worth doing? One of the things that I find interesting about looking at social class when we're talking about poverty and austerity in theological context is that it keeps a focus first on how our identities are always made in relation to others, and second on how our identities are made in ways that set us against each other and against ourselves. It's the localized, everyday, individualized, performed aspect of what Chris was talking about earlier as structural sin and systemic injustice. So first you say it's the class system or class structure that makes people middle class or working class. Class as an identity relates and divides. It relates by dividing I am made who I am out of the ways in which this system, this structure, this society relates me to others. And if class identity and class formation run deep and are not just something that's chosen or performed on special occasions, they're written on the body and on the accent and on the movement through space, on the physical and the social infrastructure that Sarah's talking about, who I am is relational all the way down. And well, that, you know, Christian theologians tend to say, oh, yes, people are relational all the way down, just like the Trinity. It's all relational. It's all lovely. It's all beautiful. Well, no, I say in terms of when I start thinking about class, because it's really obviously linked to inequality and precarity and the distribution of power and all the problems of austerity that we've been talking about earlier. Class helps us think about how the very structures of relationship that make us who we are, our relationality as persons all the way down, are, to use the non-technical theological language, messed up all the way down. Structural sin. Terminology of the implications of structural sin for identity. If you like, this is thinking a different way into the powerful and difficult biblical ideas of sinful flesh and incarnation. That we're embodied, material, historical, interdependent beings, and we are not supposed to be or become anything else. And that's just where all the problems come in. And, in theological terms, that is where salvation is encountered, in the middle of sinful flesh, which is formed by these distorting relationships to others. which is where, for me, the theological and political impact of Christian social action as everyday practices, the shifting of relationships, the reformation of habits and assumptions through being in a different place and doing different things, the deep impact of connection and celebration and care could come in. So that's quite a massive, rapid overview of large scale background. Sounds, you know, quite dramatic, but potentially quite hopeful, like Christianity has the answer to the class system, except, of course, historically, it really doesn't, rather the reverse. I have a bit to say and a few thoughts on the Christian theological background of austerity. So this is sort of the flip side of what I've been saying so far, the ways in which theology has been a problem, the ways in which theology is reinforced rather than challenged, these problematic structures of relationship. And I want to pick up particularly on a point about the moralization of poverty. I was very interested in the presentation that Stephanie and Chris began with. We had this very brief set of different forms of austerity. So we were mainly focused on economic austerity, but then we had the point about personal austerity and self-restraint. And I trust it's not too controversial to say that there's a link between the moralization of poverty, the categorization, this long-term pattern, really long-term pattern in particularly British and American thinking about poverty, the categorization of the poor as deserving or undeserving, or the demand that the poor behave in certain ways or present themselves in certain ways in order to receive anything, right? There's a strong relationship between that and the politics of austerity, at least in a democratic context where there's generally some attempt at the moral justification of policies, though that seems to be going out the window. Austerity is presented in terms of the need to restrict and constrain the flow of benefits, tough choices that meet stringent criteria. The austere politician is displaying the virtue of restraint by giving to those who in turn show the virtue of restraint, by giving to those who do not have too many children, do not have too many bedrooms, do not spend their money on things they're not supposed to. And that's set up in opposition to this sort of indiscriminate and profligate giving, the magic money tree, you know, giving benefits to people who themselves are indiscriminate and profligate, the undeserving poor with widescreen TVs. And that's the white benefit street is doing there. So thinking about a bit about how that works, how the moral judgments that are embedded in austerity work, I want to say austerity is a policy and approach, not just that it impacts classes unequally, which is what Sarah was rightly talking about, but that is itself made possible by class divisions. It's not just about the unequal distribution of resources. So it's not just about poverty, wealth and poverty. It's about the unequal prior distribution of the right to name, the right to judge, the right to categorise, the right to explain why things have to be this way and why there's no alternative, the right to tell people what to do and how to be, the right to set the moral categories. One of the ways I talk, when I talk about the deserving and the undeserving poor, I say that the first injustice, the first problem is not to call some people the undeserving poor. It's to place some people in a category where they're a category where they can be judged as deserving or undeserving in the first place, right? It's to establish that position from which I control the right to talk about to categorize the lives of others. If that all sounds a bit more abstract than the sorts of questions with which anti-poverty activism's concerned and or the areas that Sarah's talking about, I want to say these kinds of performances of judgment are embodied and performed. It's not a new thing that comes in with austerity. It just is class identity being weaponized in a crisis. And I also want to say it's theologically shaped. The voice of the judge and the explainer and the one who narrates the social future and who says this is how it's going to be and there's no alternative is a borrowed voice of divine authority. It's telling us a story in which we as a nation are the prodigals who've fallen into this terrible predicament of debt, and we're summoned by the immutable laws and decrees of the market to work out our salvation through austerity and through the kinds of behaviour working with austerity. And if you've got a position of cultural and social power, your job is to preach and teach that story and to use your authority to pull people into line with it. and your own implication and the experience of being all in together needn't make a much practical difference. I was really struck by Chris's quotation of Justin Welby talking about what's theory for the rich and the daily life of the poor. That's kind of what I'm talking about here, except sort of saying that the right to turn other people's lives into theory is itself a product of some rather complicated and deep structural injustice, which I struggle with myself. So as a theologian, I'm very interested in the lies, the specific lies that get told about poverty in the UK, but I'm even more interested in the theological shadow of the moralisation of poverty. The way that incorporating these instructions to the poor about how to behave, how to present yourselves, comes to be backed up not just by the very material threat of hunger and deprivation, but also by a threat of being excluded from the shared narrative of salvation. And the way that that so easily becomes the voice of Christian theology, because a theological voice still comes from on high, still comes from the position of the judge. So this is a problem about who's doing the theology, who's writing the stories, and whose interest theology is speaking. For a historical comparison, and that's I've got these texts up here, but I've seen a similar pattern of reasoning to the pattern that's used in justifying austerity. In my research, I've seen this playing itself out in the debates in the mid-19th century Britain about the problem of poverty. There were, for example, some really striking examples in the way that the English Protestant poor law reformers talked about the Irish Catholics, both in Ireland and in the UK. The Irish Catholics get painted as they have the bad habit of giving to anyone who asks without inquiring about what they deserve, and the bad habit of having too many children and spending their money conspicuously. And this is from for the advocates of the new poor laws. This is all very improvident, and it's all very counter to the obvious and rational degrees of divine providence, which by then are coming closer and closer in certain parts of the English imagination to the obvious and rational degrees of capitalism. That's how Thomas Malthus, you've got Malthus' essay on the principle of population here, how his famous essays on population presented the situation. He was arguing that poverty or scarcity was the suffering built into the created order as a means to incite humanity to greater efforts towards civilizational progress. Poverty was intended by God to produce hard work and thrift. It was portrayed as economics, but it's not just economics. It's a theodicy. It's an answer to what theologians call to the problem of evil, a vindication of the justice of God. But it's solving the problem first by writing poverty into a large scale story of how human society progresses. So you say there's no alternative. This is just how things are going to be. And then by blaming the improvident poor for failing to respond correctly to their poverty. That gets to be the big scale picture. And anything like any kind of obligation on the rich to give to the poor comes subsequently to that basic narrative, and shouldn't run against the divinely ordained pattern. I've got an extract here from little example here from the Nottingham Society for Organising Charity. This is late 19th century now, and going into early 20th. For the charity organisers of the late 19th century, it was not only ill-advised but unchristian to give indiscriminately, to give to poor people who were going to spend the money badly, because this was going against the order of things whereby society would gradually be improved through everybody displaying the right kinds of virtues of self-restraint and hard work and thrift. When I talk about what's wrong with this, it's easy to focus, and always you do want to focus, right? You do want to focus on the specific policies, the specific iniquities of something like the bedroom tax, which Sarah was talking about. But what I get interested I'm trying to get at in my research is the sense that there's a prior move, which is the establishment of a position of a position of the judge over against the judged, of the giver over against the receiver, of the explainer over against the explained, of the one who can see the system from the outside and explain how to talk about how the future is going to be, and the people who just have to suck it up. And that's the primary problem that we've got. Now, I realise I'm gone massively over time, so I'm going to come back to the, where I started and try and say something a little bit more specific about the political and theological force of connection, care and celebration. So I've got you more pictures of the woman in the jar of ointment here. And the headline for this section, and I'm kind of nervous about this given what else I've heard so far about questions of time and hope. But what I'm interested in is actually the revolutionary potential of the present moment. So it's a commonplace of old style liberation theology to talk, and people have already referred to this in the chat, I believe, about bringing eschatology, the talk about the end times, back to the centre of Christian theology, to say what's been lost from Christianity is the dynamic of hope, of the sense that the reign of God on earth is not yet. So what I want to suggest is the dimension of Christian anti-poverty action in a time of austerity that could challenge austerity from the other direction, because it seems to me, and I'd be really interested to hear what Sarah thinks about this, it seems to me that austerity, at least the rhetoric of austerity, has a strong sort of forward-moving narrative of national salvation, right? We're going to make sacrifices now in order to achieve a good in the future. Yeah, we've got present means totally subordinated to this sort of future end that we promised. And among other things, it's associated with a moralisation of poverty that really doesn't want people to enjoy themselves now unless they first earned their social salvation by being economically active. And it seems to me there's a powerful resistance to this narrative on the basis of the Christian gospel that comes from absolute confidence in what's already here, what is already given, so that it doesn't have to be earned or begged for, that we don't have to fix or escape from the bodies and histories we've got, because the Holy Spirit is at work in just these bodies and histories, just this flesh is beloved and saved and healed. So that Christian social action isn't just a means towards a future social end, right? You know, another way to get us to where we all know we need to go. It's a breaking into the present of an alternative vision of how things really are. It's a way of telling a new truth about the people that we have here and the people we can see before us, about their dignity and their uniqueness and their preciousness. And it's a way of envisioning practically in the present moment, common life and community across divisions. So it's about care that recognises the particular needs and longings and gifts of the person who's here, telling the truth about particular individuals. But it's also about connections that, in the way society is met up, connections that aren't meant to happen, that aren't dictated by the scripts that have been written in advance, that allow for improvisation out of the present moment. And it's about celebration, by which I mean not just patting people on the back and saying they did a good job, but daring to acknowledge that something new, acknowledge where something new is happening now, despite and in the face of the system's best expectations. In the story of the woman with the jar of ointment, it's the room that fills with the smell of the perfume, which is a powerful image in my mind of this broad shift of people's perceptions, the reordering of a changed environment. And even as I say that, I realise it's really easy to make that just sound really too nice. Yeah. To get sucked back into this idea where churches and Christian social action keep people happy and help them to tolerate an intolerable situation and settle for what they've got. I don't want to give up on care and connection on celebration. I want to say the injunction to rejoice always is subversive in a context that ruled by fear and the grim no alternative. And that remembering and speaking about beauty and pleasure and what goes beyond the necessary is subversive in a context where the foreseeable future you're being told all you're allowed is the bare essentials. But I'm also aware of how easy it is for theology to domesticate that, which is one among many reasons why I hope to learn from you.